From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
Mitt Romney and religion in America's public life. Hello again, I'm Warren Olney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. The former governor of Massachusetts said today he does not define his presidential candidacy by his Mormon religion. He promised that if he's elected, no authorities of his church will ever exert influence on presidential decisions. On To the Point, with a constitutional ban on religious tests for public office, is it political bigotry to question any candidate's faith? Or does Mormonism raise specific questions some voters have a right to ask? Did Romney tell them what they wanted to know? On Reporter's Notebook later on, two gypsy clans go to court over who controls fortune-telling in Southern California. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Warren Olney, back with To the Point. Mitt Romney said today no Mormon authority will influence what he does if he's elected president of the United States. On To the Point, with a religious test prohibited by the Constitution, should any candidate have to defend his or her religion? Does Mormonism raise special questions? Has Romney provided the answers that some voters think they have a right to ask for? On Reporter's Notebook, a dispute over fortune-telling in Southern California provides a rare glimpse into the lives of gypsies. First, this news update. With anxiety rising about the economy, President Bush today announced a plan to help homeowners with subprime mortgages. It would freeze the so-called starter interest rate for certain borrowers to prevent increases that would otherwise force them into foreclosure.
We should not bail out lenders, real estate speculators, or those who made the reckless decision to buy a home they knew they could never afford. Yet there are some responsible homeowners who could avoid foreclosure with some assistance.
Michael Mandel is chief economist for Business Week magazine, author of Rational Exuberance. Michael, good to have you back on our program.
Oh, glad to be here, Warren.
I know this is, they're still clarifying details as we speak, but the first question that occurs to me listening just now to President Bush is who determines who's a reckless borrower and who's a responsible homeowner?
Well, listening to what they're saying, it sounds like there's certain criteria that they're going to apply and what they call a streamlined process, which is that people who have a high enough credit score, they're not going to freeze the rates on. People who are behind on their loans, they're not going to freeze the rates on. And that within that category of people who are still paying their loans but maybe have a low credit score, they're going to look at them on a case-by-case basis to decide what to do with the loan. So really, this is what they're talking about here seems to be a streamlined process, but not something that's sort of they're going to just kind of apply to everybody.
Any idea at this point as to how many people might be involved?
Well, the number that they're throwing around here is that 1.2 million are eligible for consideration. But that doesn't mean that 1.2 million are going to get the freeze. It's going to be a much smaller number, but we don't know quite yet how much that's going to be. They're also sort of saying that some people who are eligible for refinancing will maybe get expedited refinancing. Other people will get some help from the FHA. In this particular case, the devil is going to be in the details. Will this really actually help enough people soon enough to make a difference?
If a homeowner wants to go and apply for this kind of assistance, who does he or she go to?
Well, President Bush gave a phone number at the press conference. I don't know. I'm not sure that I want to be at the other end of that phone number, but they gave a phone number to sort of call, and I assume that somewhere out there a bureaucracy is being set up to filter out these phone numbers, or to contact their mortgage servicer. What this really depends on is getting the entire mortgage industry on board. Right now, they're in their press conference. They're running up the different people on the mortgage lender, mortgage servicer, securitization side. The more of these financial side people they can get on board, the easier it's going to be. But you know, we're going to see lawsuits. We're going to see people on the investor side dragging their feet. This is an attempt by the government to sort of help the mortgage sector without putting in any government money. and it's going to be a little bit of a dicey business because historically you've got to put in money to make the whole thing work.
No government money and no requirement on anybody. It is all voluntary on the part of the lenders, right?
It seems to be voluntary. It seems to be no additional money, though the president was talking about certain things that were going to go through that he put up through Congress to sort of help out other parts of the housing system. I think that this is going to be a very interesting experiment in whether or not a purely voluntary set of measures can deal with what is a very huge problem.
And when you talk about investors dragging their feet, you're talking about the people who bought these securities that they put together by bundling subprime mortgages all at once, and nobody really knows who all these investors are.
And what's even more tricky than that is that there's different classes of investors. Some investors, it may be in their interest to sort of participate in this because otherwise the home would be foreclosed and they lose a lot of money. Other investors may have invested in a particular aspect of these securities where they're still getting their money. And so they might sort of say, why should I give up part of my money to sort of save these other people? Not everybody has the same interest. And there's really no good mechanism for getting everybody on board. It's a workout. It's a giant-sized workout with, millions of people on one side and hundreds of thousands of investors on the other side. This is a very tricky thing.
And with all these investors, nobody really knows, in some cases, who actually owns the property.
Well, no, but that's right. There's that problem where there seems to be some issue about the paperwork that was connected with these securities, whether or not is correctly in place to sort of do the foreclosure, so that some of the homeowners may not want to participate either. They say, okay, you can't do anything to us because you don't have the right documentation. We're going to discover at the end of the day that this is going to be one amazing mess.
Michael Mandel, Chief Economist, Business Week Magazine, author of Rational Exuberance. As always, thanks a lot for being with us.
Glad to be here.
In a moment, Mitt Romney and religion in America's public life on To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 10,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warren, I'll be back with To the Point. Massachusetts Senator John Kennedy became America's first Catholic president after a speech in which he said no Catholic prelate would tell him what to do in the White House. In Texas today, less than 100 miles from where Kennedy made his address more than 40 years ago, former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney said this about authorities in his own Mormon church.
Let me assure you that no authorities of my church, or of any other church for that matter, will ever exert influence on presidential decisions. Their authority is theirs within the province of church affairs, and it ends when the affairs of the nation begin.
Mitt Romney making a much-awaited speech today in the George H.W. Bush Library in College Station, Texas. Neil Swidey was there for the Boston Globe. Neil, thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
You have been covering Mitt Romney for a long time as governor and now as presidential candidate. Why did he make this speech?
You know, there's been a debate for the entire campaign, within the campaign, about when to do it. Almost even before he began his run for the presidency, people talked about making the Kennedy speech, it's called. Because there are so many questions about the Mormon faith in America now, as there were almost 50 years ago with the Catholic faith. And so today I think he felt he needed to do it, pressed, I think, largely by an eroding lead that he had in the polls in Iowa.
The eroding lead in the polls with former Governor Huckabee of Arkansas coming on strong. He, of course, a former Baptist preacher.
Exactly. And there was some sense among religious conservatives in Iowa that Huckabee's gains were a result of continuing concerns on the part of voters about Romney's religion. So I think that was the backdrop to making the speech today. Although, as I said, there's been talk from the beginning about if but when.
How important does this become for Romney, who is trying very hard, it would appear, from what he's been saying on the campaign trail, to be the candidate of the right, and that includes the religious right?
Yeah, that's certainly the case today. that you heard Romney talking about reaching out to all kinds of people of religious backgrounds. What he didn't reach out to were people who obviously don't believe in God. I mean, that wasn't his point, and those aren't any prospective voters, I think, for Romney. But within that sort of range of people, especially people who are classify their religion as an important issue in voting, Romney is trying to make his case to them. But again, it's an interesting point because he's doing it not as the standard bearer of a traditional mainline Christian denomination, but from a religious faith that a lot of people don't know much about and many conservative Christians have questions about.
We just heard him say that no authority in his church will ever exert influence on presidential decisions. But he also said, did he not, that there ought to be a place for religion in public life. How does he resolve that contradiction in terms of the separation between church and state?
It's a good question. I think you've hit on the key difference between in Romney and his position and his goals for this speech with Kennedy in 1960. Kennedy was trying at the time to allay people's concerns that coming from the Catholic faith that he would be beholden to his religious leaders more so than to the needs of the country at the time, and that in a pinch he might defer to a religious high authority as opposed to a more secular authority. Romney is also trying to do that, but at the same time, as you point out, he's trying not to, he's trying all to shore up his support from people who feel that that distinction between church and state has been, there's been too much cleavage there, and that that the part of God in government has been too watered down. So it was a very tricky place for Romney to be.
Again, Neil Swidey is a reporter for the Boston Globe, joining us today from College Station, Texas, where Governor Mitt Romney has finished his speech. Damon Linker is Senior Writing Fellow at the Center for Critical Writing at the University of Pennsylvania. He's formerly an editor at the Religious Journal. He's all at First Things as well. He has been a political philosophy professor, rather, at Brigham Young University, and he's author of The Theocons, Secular America Under Siege. Damon Linker, good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
We know, and Governor Romney referred to it today, that the Constitution says there shall be no test, no religious test, for holding office in the United States. Is there an argument, nonetheless, for asking about the Mormon religion of Governor Romney or anybody else who's running for public office?
I think there certainly is, and it wouldn't in any way fall under the prohibition of a religious test in the Constitution. I mean, that prescribes a legal test, either requiring someone who's running for office to belong to an established church, which of course we don't have, or to exclude certain people because they don't belong to the established church. And obviously, that doesn't apply really in any case these days. I mean, back at the founding period, there were established churches in some states. But in our time, it doesn't apply, and certainly it doesn't apply to the deliberations of individual citizens as they try to make decisions about who to vote for. And in that sense, it's perfectly legitimate to raise questions, especially when you're a candidate like Mitt Romney, who, as your reporter guest just said, really wants to be the leader of the religious right, which seeks to inject religion and religious categories and ideas and moral principles into political life. Once you do that, then the door, I believe, is open to ask very pointed and serious questions about the religious faith of politicians. I would also add, by the way, that I think Romney did a pretty good job of doing that in this speech. He was very clear that in the segment that you played at the top of the show, that that he would not take orders from anyone in the faith from his church. That that once he gave an oath of office, that his duty would be to the Constitution, and that the authority of the church would not interfere with that. That certainly was enough to settle any misgivings I might have had about him.
Damon Linker, I should make clear, you are of the Catholic faith. You have been a professor, however, at Brigham Young University, and you've written extensively about the Mormon religion. We don't have time to go into it in detail, but what are the specifics of that religion that make you say, as you just did, that there is reason for questioning how the faith would play a role for a presidential candidate?
Well, there are two main things. First of all, Mormonism is very much wrapped up with the United States and the American founding. Mormons tend to believe that God providentially raised up the American founders to create a nation where Mormonism, what they call the restored gospel of Jesus Christ, could thrive, and that it is not an official doctrine, but it is widely believed by many Mormons that the second coming of Christ and all of the apocalyptic events that go along with that are likely to take place, if not entirely in the United States, then at least partially here. So the U.S. has a very intimate role to play with the end of the world as we know it now. And that, I think, raises legitimate questions that one might ask of a candidate. And then I think even more pressingly, there's the very crucial role of prophecy in Mormonism. You know, Jews, Christians who are non-Mormons, and then Muslims all believe in prophecy as well, but all of them believe to one extent or another that the age of prophecy is behind us. Mormons believe, by contrast, that God has raised up modern prophets among us, including Joseph Smith, the founder of Mormonism. And the head of the Mormon Church in Salt Lake City is considered to be a prophet himself, God's mouthpiece on earth. And that raises, certainly if there were questions to John F. Kennedy about whether and to what extent he would take orders from the Pope, as people used to put it, certainly one may ask, at least for discussion, a Mormon candidate, well, how do you feel about the fact that there is God's mouthpiece on earth living out there in Salt Lake City? What if he were to ask you to do something or to announce that some event is taking place, say, God, you know, Jesus Christ has returned or whatever it may be? It's perfectly legitimate, I think, and even necessary to ask a question, to pose a question like that to him, given that he may well be president. Romney may be president, and God's prophet is living here among us.
Again, Damon Linker is at the Center for Critical Writing at the University of Pennsylvania, formerly was professor at Brigham Young University. He himself, once again, is Catholic. Richard Bushman is professor emeritus of history at Columbia University. He'll be visiting professor in Mormon studies at the Claremont Graduate University in California next year. He's author of Joseph Smith, Rough Stone Rolling, Joseph Smith, the founder of Mormonism, and that a biography of that person. And Professor Bushman himself is Mormon, and it's good to have you with us.
Thank you.
We just heard that Governor Romney said today that no authorities of my church or any other church will ever exert influence on presidential decisions. Does that make it, then, unnecessary to ask the kinds of questions Damon Linker just raised?
I think they're perfectly legitimate questions. You can always ask, what do your basic religious beliefs, how do they affect your actions in politics? So, yes, they should be asked. I don't think they're terribly damaging questions in Romney's case. There are a lot of Americans who believe that this is a promised land that God favors. Mormons just have kind of an accentuated version of it, but lots of people sort of blend that with their patriotism. Prophecy does accentuate the issue of religious authority. The Pope isn't spoken of as a prophet, but he certainly is, has the right to declare doctrine and to speak about almost any issue. So I think for that reason, Mormons are in the same category with the Pope, but in a different way, and perhaps more strongly. So for that reason, Romney's comment, which, as Damon Linker suggests, really tried definitively to put the issue to rest, is of a great significance and has to be taken very carefully because of so much of what is at stake.
Well, if this question with regard to prophecy, for example, is fair enough to ask, how do you think he would answer? He didn't say this in his speech today, but what if somebody said to him, all right, what if the prophet, current prophet, the head of the Mormon Church, were to tell you to do something as a president, would you do it or not?
Well, I thought he did answer it, actually, that he said the prophet has authority within the realm of the church, but that within the realm of politics, at least it's Mitt Romney's credo that you have to go by your loyalty to the Constitution and the good of the American people. So I think his answer is no, he would have to follow his own conscience in that case.
Wouldn't he then be refuting his own church and going beyond its teachings?
Well, he would put himself in tension with the prophet, but it's such a hypothetical because for a century, the Mormon leadership has said over and over again that it does not try to control the consciences or the policies of Mormon politicians. So the Mormon leadership would be going against its own pronouncements if it were to try to deliver such a dictum to the to a Mormon president.
We've heard from Richard Bushman at Columbia, a Mormon. We've heard from Damon Linker at the University of Pennsylvania, a Catholic. Let us hear a little bit more from Governor Romney. Here's a statement that he made in the following context. He invoked the constitutional ban on any religious test for public office, but then he sounded as if he needed to pass one.
There's one fundamental question about which I'm often asked. What do I believe about Jesus Christ? I believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God and the Savior of mankind. My church's beliefs about Christ may not all be the same as those of other faiths. Each religion has its own unique doctrines and history. These are not bases for criticism, but rather a test of our tolerance.
Those who with the evangelical persuasion have been among those said to be concerned about Governor Romney. We just have a moment left for our next guest, but I'll get a topic statement out of her, and then we'll go to a break and come right back, let her finish her point. She is Janice Krause, spokesperson for Concerned Women of America, a conservative Christian group, and she is an evangelical. Ms. Krause, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome.
Are you satisfied by what we just heard?
I don't think it matters whether I'm satisfied or not. I think he showed he cared about his beliefs at the same time respecting other people's beliefs. And I think that's what most people wanted to hear from him today.
Okay. Janice Krause again with the Concerned Women for America. We'll return and hear more from her and our other guests later in the program. On Reporter's Notebook, The Secret Culture of Gypsies is getting a public airing in Southern California. We'll hear about that. It has to do with fortune telling. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
A complete archive of past programs is available online at kcrw.com/to the point. You can also order a CD copy by calling 1-888-600-5279.
Mormon Olney back with To the Point, talking today about Mitt Romney's speech in Texas about religion and very specifically his Mormon faith. We heard him say that if he were to be elected president, no authority of his church or any other church would exert influence on presidential decisions. We're talking now with Janice Krause with Concerned Women for America. She is an evangelical. And Ms. Krause, undoubtedly you have seen survey after survey that shows that people are concerned about Governor Mitt Romney's Mormonism, and very specifically that evangelicals are, partly because of the different way in which Jesus Christ is viewed by his church from the way that it has been viewed by traditional Christians and evangelicals as well. So let me ask you to elaborate on what you just said. I take it you think that he resolved concerns about that?
No, I didn't mean to say that.
Oh, I say, okay.
He glossed over the theological differences in a very effective way, I think. He talked about the theological differences not being as significant as the fact that we shared moral ideals. And I think that was an important tack to take. In fact, the whole speech, I think, will come to be known as the Symphony of Religion speech, because he did a beautiful job of framing his arguments in terms of religious liberty rather than specifically talking about his own beliefs in depth. And I think he allied himself against what he called the godless secularism. And I think many people in America are far more concerned with that than they are specific theological differences. As far as evangelicals are concerned, I think we'll be happy that he did acknowledge that there are very distinct differences between Mormons and Christians in terms of Jesus. And also, he allayed the arguments that the church authorities will dictate to him what he should do. He went on record as saying that would not be the case. But, you know, beyond any of the specifics of his arguments, I think he had the limelight. He looked presidential. He handled a very tough topic in a way that I think will draw respect to him. He talked about the separation of church and state and accurately said that, you know, secularism has become the new religion in America. And I think many Americans are very tired of arguments over whether the creche or the minarah should be in the public square. And he talked about the fact that we are one nation under God and we do trust God. And it's one thing to separate the affairs of government from religion, but not to separate American people from God. So I think he did an excellent job of establishing that you can't have a movement of conscience without talking about the convictions of American people and religious people specifically.
You just referred to the difference between Mormons and Christians. Do you not believe that Mormons are Christians?
I said that to make a distinction because I think that's generally how most people refer to it. Mormons believe they are Christians. Christians, evangelicals, and people who believe in the Bible as the sole word of God have very distinct theological differences with Mormons. However, most evangelicals who work in the public square end up working with Mormons because we share so many beliefs in terms of the breakdown of the family, in terms of the importance of moral values, in terms of building a strong democratic society, and in terms of respecting religious freedom. Yes, there is a distinct difference theologically, but those theological differences pale when you start looking at the moral ideas that we share.
What's important to you is to have a religious person in the White House. Would that be a fair statement?
No, and I disagree with my friend Damon's statement that the religious right is working to get religious ideas into the public, into political life. I think probably Huckabee ought to be the one to have given the speech that Romney gave today, because I think evangelicals and people for whom the Bible is a document of authority have been crucified far more than the Mormons have. I think people of faith, whether they are evangelical or Mormon, respect other people's views, but they also expect to be respected for their views. And in so many respects, I think evangelical faith is a bigger obstacle for the media and for some of the elites than is Mormonism.
Janice Krause again with Concerned Women for America. Barry Lynn is Executive Director of Americans United for Separation of Church and State. He is also an ordained minister of the United Church of Christ. He's author of a new book, Piety in Politics, The Right-Wing Assault on Religious Freedom, just out in paperback. Barry Lynn, good to have you back on our program.
Nice to be back.
Where do you come down on all of this, and do you agree with Governor Romney, you yourself a ordained minister, that secularism has become a new religion?
No, certainly secularism has not become a new religion in this country. And Janice Krause just said that this speech will be remembered as the Symphony of Religion speech. That was a good line, but it would be more accurate to call this the Symphony of Religion without the violin section. Because in all of the comments Governor Romney made this morning, he never once even acknowledged that there are 20 million non-believers, atheists, agnostics, secularists, in that sense, ideological sense of the word, free thinkers in the country, and he didn't even pay a passing notice to any of them. So he does seem to have an established, not a religious test for public office, but a kind of religious test for being an American. That is, you have to have some religion. I was very disappointed in that. Even President Bush has occasionally acknowledged non-believers as complete Americans. So that was very disappointing.
How disappointing is that in the terms of the Constitution?
Well, it's very, because it also means that perhaps the governor does not really understand what the separation of church and state that he said was so important really means. I think it was very unusual, for example, to have someone speak on this topic and never mention the names Thomas Jefferson or James Madison, who were the architects not only of most of the Constitution, but certainly of the idea of religious freedom. Instead, he turned to John Adams in some fairly obscure quotations, as if John Adams somehow wrote the Bill of Rights or the religious freedom documents that are the foundation of our country. Again, as he was, this one hand saying, I'm not going to talk about doctrine, and frankly, I respect Damon's view on this, but I don't think that reporters ought to ask questions about doctrine. Of course, they're entitled to. But
now, Richard Bushman also said those were legitimate questions.
Yeah, I don't really think they are legitimate questions, but I think they're legitimate to ask in a sense, but it's also legitimate for candidates not to answer them. But that when you say, as he did, I'm not going to discuss Mormon doctrine, and then moments later says, oh, by the way, I do want to tell you about Jesus Christ. He is the Son of God. He is the Savior of mankind. I would think he broke his own pledge not to talk about doctrine. So I do think he was speaking a bit out of both sides of his mouth in doing so. I don't want anybody to get the wrong impression. I do think people in America want politicians to know that they have values. In other words, what are your values are legitimate questions. What policy positions do you derive from those values? Another fair question. What I think is not important is what is the source of those values, whether it's a Bible quotation or a particular other religious book or the secular manifesto, a humanist manifesto. I don't think that the basis of those values should be scrutinized in a presidential campaign. Senator Bill Bradley of New Jersey used to say when asked about religion, it is so personal that I do not want to talk about it during a campaign for elective office. And I wish more politicians, frankly, would give that answer and let it go at that.
Barry Lynn, again, ordained minister in the United Church of Christ and director of Americans United for Separation of Church and State. Let me go back to our first guest, Damon Linker at the University of Pennsylvania, our Catholic commentator, a former professor at Brigham Young University. What do you think that the speech today came at the right time? Will Governor Romney be seen to have settled these issues in his candidacy, or do you think he will have stimulated yet more discussion, drawn more attention than ever to his religion?
Well, I wrote an article about a year ago about Mitt Romney and Mormonism in his campaign, and I predicted then that he would give a speech like this last January. Well, I guess I was about 11 months late, but, what can you do? I think my initial feeling before the speech was that he had made a mistake in waiting so long, because if it didn't go well, he now has so much less time to clean up the mess. But my sense so far since he gave the speech this morning is that the reaction is fairly positive. Certainly on the right, at least from scanning through the internet this morning and reading some things online, it seems among conservatives the response is quite positive. So, he took a huge risk, but if it's well received, then I think his polling will show a nice bump, and he will have settled a lot of people's concerns. The question about whether evangelicals as a group will kind of see Mitt Romney now as a viable representative for their views and choose him over, say, Huckabee, who seems to be surging right now, especially among evangelicals, I think is still an open question. We don't know it yet. But I think he did a good job. I mean, in the end, his job was an impossible one, because he was trying to do blatantly contradictory things. Say, he says, I'm a Mormon. I'll never listen to what my church authorities might tell me to do while I'm president, because my oath is to the Constitution. On the other hand, America has to have religion in politics, and it's not only a good thing to have religion in politics, but as he said, freedom requires religion just as much as religion requires freedom. So we have to have religion in our politics, yet he won't talk about his own. So what is that religion? Well, it's basically just morality, but it's not just kind of general watery morality. It's the morality that the most religious, devout Christians in America affirm. And so, again, in the end, at the highest level, this was an impossible task. But given the political situation, I think he did as good a job as one could have hoped, and it was well delivered. So,
Damon Linker,
I think he will benefit from it.
University of Pennsylvania. Back to Janice Krauss with Concerned Women for America. How do you deal with what appears to Damon Linker and others as well as a contradiction here? And what about these 20 million non-believers in the United States? Doesn't he have to be their president, too? Janice Krauss, you with us?
Yes, I'm with you. I think he dealt with that by implication, by talking about being the president of all the people, not just the people of the Mormon faith. So I don't believe that's a fair argument. I do think, though,
he didn't say anything about non-believers, though.
No, he didn't. But why should he? Because his whole job, his whole purpose in the speech was to stay focused on the question of faith and doctrine, faith and the presidency and the political process. So to have veered off to talk about non-believers would have been muddying the waters. And I think he was very wise to stay very focused because this was not a speech about non-believers. It was a speech about people of faith.
Well, where do non-believers fit in, and what would you say about the non-believers? Do they have as much right as anybody else to their beliefs and to the services of the government to which they pay taxes?
Well, of course they do, and the very fact that Romney had to make this speech is an indication that defending his right as a person of faith is the really sticky point today, not the plight of the unbelievers. The unbelievers now have sway, and it's Romney who is having to defend his position rather than someone like Barry Lynn. So I think it shows the state of where we are in terms of people of faith today. I thought the speech was something that needed to be done, and I was very glad he did it because we do have to establish the fact that America was founded for freedom of religion. That was one of the prime factors in forming America, and it's one of the underlying tenets of democracy. So we have to defend that, and I think Romney did a nice job of doing that by framing the whole debate in that context. I think he created a very special place for his candidacy.
Barry Lynn, back to you. Again, ordained minister, United Church of Christ, also director of Americans United for Separation of Church and State. Do you agree with what the governor said, that you can't have freedom without religion?
No, I don't, and I think that's one of the things that makes it very clear that he was writing off the 20 million people in America who don't believe in a spiritual path in their lives. Our religion requires freedom. Freedom requires religion, he said. In other words, this is back to this religious test I talked about earlier. You can be an American, but you got to be religious to be a first-class one. And Janice's comment here about he felt the need to defend being a person of faith, well, I'll tell you, Mike Huckabee and Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama are all talking, I would say often too frequently, about their faith. But nevertheless, they don't feel obliged to give this speech. This speech was given because he is a Mormon. And as Damon pointed out, that means he has to do what is, in fact, an impossible job, explain that he's sincere about his faith, but also not really talk about it, because that just gets him into more questions, more quicksand about exactly what he believes. And once you enter that that swamp, you can get swallowed up in it.
Let me go back to the Mormon on our program, Richard Bushman, professor emeritus at Columbia University, author of Joseph Smith, Rough Stone Rolling, a biography about the founder of Mormonism. An impossible job, say at least two of our other guests. How do you think the governor did, and was this the right time?
I thought it was a great talk myself, and the timing was quite astute. I think that no candidate is required to talk about all of their religious beliefs, but the beliefs Damon Linker was referring to were beliefs that bear directly on politics.
Right.
And that, I think, he does have to answer. And he didn't handle all the ones that Damon talks about, But he did talk about the moral values that are most important to him and the beliefs that are most important to him. It's true that I agree that bringing up Jesus Christ in a way went beyond his own dicta that you don't bring religion into politics. But we all know the situation that the largest number of voters in the country are Christians, and this is of immense importance to them. So I'm willing to grant him a little inconsistency in stating where he stands there.
What about the 20 million unbelievers?
That, I think, was an unaddressed problem. And I think that 20 million unbelievers have a right to ask Mitt Romney, where do we stand in your panorama of religions and non-religions? And I think he'd probably have a pretty good answer. I don't know exactly what the non-believers want. Is it just acknowledgement, or do they want the removal of religion from the public sphere? Then there would be a debate. And I think it's a debate that's going on in the discussions of the founders. Were they religious or not? And it's a genuine debate whether religion, a belief in God, underlies the notion of human rights.
Okay, we need to leave that for other programs, although it certainly does stem very logically from what we've been talking about. I'm interested because you, Richard Bushman, are the only Mormon on the program. You're also the only one who really thinks that many questions remain unanswered and that the governor ought to address them.
I think he will in time, and I hope Barry will be in there pitching.
Barry Lynn, quickly, last question to you, and just a few seconds to answer it. But do non-believers, do you think, want to simply eliminate faith from the public square?
Absolutely not. They're as happy to have an argument in the public square. I can't speak for them because I'm a person of faith, but I can say that the many who are members of my organization just want a role at the table, a place at the table, an ability to debate all the issues in an appropriate venue. And I can't think of any who that think the appropriate place to discuss matters of theology is while you're in the middle of a presidential campaign talking about national security, the federal courts, and immigration.
All right. Obviously, an argument that goes to the very basis of Americanism and what it means, and also to the basis of faith and how it should play a role in public life. Thank you all very much for being with us. Barry Lynn, a director of Americans United for Separation of Church and State. His book, Piety and Politics, The Right-Wing Assault on Religious Freedom, out very soon. He also a minister of the United Church of Christ. Janice Krauss with Concerned Women for America, conservative Christian group and evangelical herself. Richard Bush at Columbia University. Again, his book, Joseph Smith, Rough Stone Rolling, biography of the founder of Mormonism. David Linker at the University of Pennsylvania, and his book, The Theocons, Secular America Under Siege. And our earlier guest, Neil Swidey from the Boston Globe. Thanks all of you very much for being with us today. In affluent Newport Beach in Orange County, California, two gypsy clans have gone into court in a turf war over fortune-telling. It's a rare public airing of customs and practices that normally are kept secret from the rest of the world. More on that in a moment on To the Point.
For more information about To the Point or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/to the point.
Well, I'm only back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. The Marino clan of gypsies claims that the Stevens clan broke into an office, stole a credit card machine, and threatened to kill a Marino couple if they didn't shut down a fortune-telling operation. It is a turf war that has spread into civil court and revealed a system of intermarriage and social customs that goes back for generations. Anne Sutherland is an anthropologist at the University of California in Riverside. Her book is Gypsies, The Hidden Americans. Professor, good to have you with us.
Hello.
The Associated Press has written this up in a rather lurid way, talking about the kinds of details that I just mentioned and saying that it sounds a little bit like a gangster movie or something. I don't know that we want to investigate that so much as we do what's behind it, but what can you tell us about this kind of dispute, let's put it that way, over fortune-telling between two gypsy clans?
It's definitely not a gangster situation, that's for sure, but they have always kind of divided up areas where they could work and have fortune-telling parlors or oficinas, as they call them. And so this seems to be a dispute between, for a very lucrative area of Orange County, between two families who are related and are part of the same sort of nation of gypsies.
Interesting that this should take place in Newport Beach, California, which is a very affluent town. I take it there's a lot of fortune-telling business there.
There may not be a large number of businesses, but I think it's very lucrative.
Why is it that gypsies have been so good at fortune-telling?
Well, they are good at it. The women do the fortune-telling and exclusively, and they train the younger women, the older women do, and they are just really good at reading cultural cues that people give out and being able to figure out all kinds of things about people just by being around them. And so the clients feel that there's some kind of uncanny ability to see into their future or their soul or whatever.
Are disputes, particularly of this kind, this one got apparently violent, or at least there were threats of violence, common among gypsies?
No, not really threats of violence, but certainly, it can become very heated, and heated discussions are fairly common. It's very uncommon to actually take things to court and get restraining orders, but I think that's happening more and more as they're willing to use the American legal system to support their own legal system. They have their own set of trials and so on.
Your book, again, is called Gypsies, the Hidden Americans. Are they becoming more mainstream?
Well, I think this case is an example of people are now noticing that they actually are in Huntington Beach and Newport Beach. But, you know, again, the surprise by most Americans that they even exist here, it means that they're not that visible to other Americans. But they've been here a long time, and their presence in the L.A. area is pretty ubiquitous. I mean, they're all over the L.A. area, so lots of different families.
What other parts of the country are they located in?
Mainly in cities, like New York City has a big population, Chicago, the Bay Area, Houston. I'm in Riverside, and there are families here with fortune-telling parlors. So, and this is pretty much the boondocks as far as L.A. is concerned.
Why have they worked so hard? Well, first of all, an estimate of the total number would be interesting, I think, to a lot of our listeners. And then the second question, why have they worked so hard to be hidden Americans, to use your title?
We really don't know the numbers. The guess is around 1 million right now in the United States, but of course worldwide it's tens of millions, and you know, much more more numbers in Eastern Europe and so on, Russia. But they have a long history. They for at least 1,000 years when they left northern India and began migrating of keeping their to themselves, marrying each other, not marrying outside, and running their own lives. And you know, they were nomadic, and so they really just moved on, and it's worked for them. That has worked for them to be keep themselves separate and secretive. I think it's working less now. I don't think they're becoming assimilated, but they're becoming a little more mainstream than they used to.
Has that the tendency toward separation led to discrimination, or is it discrimination that led to the tendency toward secretiveness?
It's both. There's a tremendous discrimination against gypsies in this country as well as other places, and, I mean, to the point of persecution, really serious persecution, but the gypsies also have preferred to maintain their own customs and their own lives without necessarily being involved in, you know, U.S. politics or things like that, or even schools. So it's both. They are very discriminated against. Landlords won't rent to them and things like that. So and that's why they work for themselves. They set up their own businesses and rather than work for an employer because of the discrimination.
We talked about fortune-telling and their particular talent at it, as a business. What are some of the other unique aspects of gypsy culture?
Well, the women are the fortune-tellers. The men often do body and fender work and other kind of buying and trading cars. They're very good at that. And so they manage to make a living doing these kinds of things that they create for themselves these kinds of jobs.
And you said they originated in northern India. They're often called the Roma. Why is that?
In their language, which is Romani, they refer to themselves as the Roma. But there are many, many groups of gypsies here in the United States as well as elsewhere that are not necessarily Roma. There's a complex organization of different groups, and groups that have settled in one place, like in Hungary, they became musicians primarily and sort of became a separate group. They're still gypsies, but they're not necessarily Roma. The Caló in Spain with the flamingo in the caves and so on of Spain. So there's lots of different groups. Roma or Romani we use as a sort of general term.
Anne Sutherland, again, a professor of anthropology at the University of California at Riverside. Her book, Gypsies, the Hidden Americans, an interesting look into a much little-known part of our culture. Today's program produced by Katie Cooper with Christian Bordahl and Karen Radziner. I'm Warman Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.